This is Mr. Flansburgh.
It's Mr. Maynard here speaking to you from Sydney. How's the wonderful South Australian capital, Adelaide, treating you?
We've been having sort of crazy travel days where we have to leave at the crack of dawn, which it doesn't do a lot for my sleep cycle or my tourism.
On tour, it can be pretty stressful. And as you said, it's easy to get sick.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to get sick and it's hard to get well. You know, I've been taking my vitamins.
I'm glad to hear that, Mr. Flansburgh. Let's get down to business here with the Jonathan Colton version of Baby's Got Back.
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You are the brothers, can't deny. When a girl walks in with an itty bitty waist and a round thing in your face.
And Glee completely ripping that off. Where do you guys sit on that?
I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. When a girl walks in with a nitty bitty waist and a round thing in your face.
When the whole thing happened, I actually, you know, right as the story was kind of breaking, he gave me a call. It's, you know, it's a very curious sort of gray area in terms of intellectual property because the song is actually a cover, but it's completely rearranged and reharmonized. I think to feel a succinct quote from Eddie Van Halen talking about the sample of Wild Thing from the Van Halen record that was on the Tone Loc album, it's just weak.
It almost sounds as if they may have actually taken the banjo sample from Jonathan Colton's version as well.
In an era of Pro Tools and digital music recording, a lot of people are basically doing like sort of the musical equivalent of stem cell research. A lot of it's clearly replayed, but it's replayed on top of the track. I'm not a stranger of the ways of music for television. I've been called upon to do various things where you're creating a new piece of music to swap out for temp music that they knew they would never be able to license, but you have to match like the BPM and you have to hit the same beats because the visual edits are the same thing. But what Glee is doing, I think, is they're basically crossing the line. It's not the first progressive a cappella or rearranged song that they've stolen the concepts from.
I believe the legal authorities would say they have form in this area.
It's an interesting thing. I don't think there is a legal remedy. I just think it's artistically bankrupt. And that can be noted by all.
Do you think it's very uncanny that our national broadband carrier, Telstra, is almost exactly the same spelling as Tesla?
I don't know what it means. Tesla's kind of a controversial character even to this day. I mean, Edison has really emerged the historic victor in the world of great inventors. I think maybe Tesla didn't serve himself by being so litigious himself. He was one of those guys who seemed like kind of a nut.
Your ballad about him is just beautiful. It's nice to hear a lovely ballad about a scientist, and you cover it all. And when I saw you live in Sydney, you said that one verse was fictional. Was that about the death ray or not?
It's only one fact that is really contested. I mean, the bulk of it, even down to, there's a line in the song about how he's lying dead on the floor of his apartment, of his hotel room, and there's birds flying out the window. And that's actually, he was a bird enthusiast and had a collection of pigeons in his apartment. And so evidently, like, upon the death scene, like, one of the things that the police reported was that there were just, like, birds flying in everywhere. And it's, like, it's incredibly chaotic.
The Hotel New Yorker, he's dead on the floor. The body of Nikolai lies with just his papers, no family to tell. Skull. The plan for the death ray's design, Tesla.
So there are a lot of details in the song that are actually drawn directly from the history of his life and death. But the death ray story is something that Tesla enthusiasts play up a lot. I think it's sort of, you know, somewhere between JFK conspiracy theories and the truth we'll never know falls the facts of Tesla's death ray. There's people who say that like FBI came into the apartment and basically swept it of materials, of papers.
Well, the Second World War was going on at the time, so they may have been looking for something there.
You know, I mean, he was involved in lasers, so, I mean, it's not hard to imagine. He basically contributed a lot of the innovations that made lasers powerful. So it's not hard to imagine that he was working on something that could be referred to as a death ray. I mean, a laser beam you could call a laser beam a death ray, I suppose.
Do you think you'll be paying a visit to the museum they're going to build on the site of his old laboratory?
It is very rare for us to actually do anything that crosses what appears to be the zeitgeist. You know, we're often just kind of over on the left, minding our own business in the world of popular culture. But from the time that we started working on this Tesla song and it coming out, there's all of a sudden all this renewed interest in Tesla. We're excited just to be in the mix.
And you guys are definitely behind Science. Science is Real is a fantastic song.
Oh, thank you.
From the Big Bang to the DNA, that whole album, and it was a children's album as well, so kids could get into science.
Hello!
Hello!
We are They Might Be Giants.
And we want to welcome you to our musical laboratory. As the philosopher Rudolf Carnap once so clearly said,
science is a system of statements based on direct experience and controlled by experimental verification.
Or as we say,
science is real, from the Big Bang to DNA. Science is real.
Was this partially a reaction to all the pseudoscience that's around or not?
I don't know much about Australian culture, but there's this a lot of very dull-witted anti-science sentiment in the United States, including a movement to teach, I believe the expression is teach the controversy, which is to say, sort of dismantle regular science education and turn it into this sort of open-ended, unknowable list of superstitions and fake science. And the truth is, a lot of the ideas of science are not controversial. And you can understand that when you fly in a plane, when you talk on a telephone. Science is something that, it's a very reasonable pursuit. It's not based on superstition, and it's important that people not just let their imaginations get ahead of them.
John Flansburg, you did actually make a small mistake when you were doing the science album. The sun, you said the sun's a ball of gas, and it turns out that it's plasma. Was that the slight mistake?
Well, we very notoriously covered a song that was written in the 60s on an album that John and I both heard as children called Science Songs, which was recorded by a fellow named Tom Glazer. And he recorded a song called Why Does the Sun Shine? Parentheses, the sun is a mass in incandescent gas. The song was written by Tom Glazer and Hi Zarit, and basically it's an Irish folk melody, kind of a curious hybrid of a song because it has a very strange cadence. The words don't rhyme, and the meter is very kind of herky-jerky.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees.
It was the best science of 1965, I would imagine, but it emerges that since then, it was the one thing on the album that we didn't run by our science consultant. Because it was from another source, we assumed that the facts were straight. It seems like a very reasonable song, but basically, science's best understanding of the sun now is that the sun is essentially plasma. It's not a massive incandescent gas.
The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply made out of gas. No, no, no. The sun is a quagmire. It's not made of fire. Forget what you've been told in the past.
Plasma.
Electrons are free.
Plasma.
A fourth state of matter, not gas. Not liquid, not solid.
The new album is Nanobots. It's great to have you in the country again after 12 years, because where have you been?
For a long time, we were getting a lot of sort of negative reports. Rock promoters are not, by temperament, the most optimistic bunch. We always felt like we had a very solid audience in Australia. We'd always done pretty solid business, and I think we always felt like there's something about Australian audiences that actually really runs parallel to the spirit of what we're doing, which is that although we are deeply invested in what we're doing and very passionate about what we're doing, we also don't take ourselves completely seriously. And I think that that is a balancing act, that it's important that we succeed in kind of the more lighthearted parts of what we do with solid melodies and good songwriting, and compared to a lot of other rock bands, we're very upbeat. It's not just for laughs, I guess, is the thing.
I think there's something in the Australian psyche that we don't take many things seriously, but at the same time, we appreciate artistry, and I think that's where you guys fit into it.
I feel like there's sort of a kindred spirit, Nate, between They Might Be Giants and Australia that is actually quite rare. I mean, we might actually fare better here professionally than in a lot of other territories.
Is there a problem somewhere where you go, oh, that they just do those funny novelty songs? Do you get written off like that sometimes?
We've been doing this for 30 years, and when we first started, when we were basically seen as essentially like an art project, we had tremendous success in Germany, where I think we were perceived as bohemians, very much in the tradition of Frank Zappa, who is held in very high regard there. The way rock music is consumed by the counterculture there is highly politicized.
And they enjoy the tinkering, like your Giorgio Moroder and your Kraftwerk.
You know, just because you stand apart from the mainstream culture doesn't mean you stand against the mainstream culture. I don't think we're not like shaking our fists at the radio going like, how can this stand? You know, we like a lot of different kinds of music, and we listen to what we like to listen to. It's not a culture war for us. When we started, we were very much seen as culture warriors against the mainstream in Germany. And then over time, especially as we became more commercially viable as an international act, I think it was very hard for them to understand us and take us at face value. I think it was sort of like, I think they just thought, oh, these guys, they're just entertainers. You know, we made a mistake. And I think the truth is actually something entirely different.
One of my favorite albums of yours is Apollo 18. There's something about that album that really resounded with me. And I love the song Turn Around, probably because it's the only song I could think of that uses the word obsequious.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, obsequious is a great word.
I was working all night in my office when a man I had recently killed called me up from the phone near my building. So I looked out the window at him. He had the same obsequious manner that was the reason I had him killed. So to calm my nerves, I sang this song to him. Turn around, turn around. There's a thing there that can be found.
I mean, you never hear it. I mean, Beyonce has never used it once. What's going on there?
I don't know. I think she might be tuned into obsequiousness. I think she's probably tired of it.
I'm a big fan of the Star Trek pajamas. If you were to get the Star Trek pajamas, would you go for the red shirt, the blue shirt, or the gold shirt?
Well, unfortunately, I think I'd probably look a little bit too much like William Shatner in any of them. It's sort of an unflattering look for bulky guys. You got to be really thin to rock a turtleneck, I think. But I guess I'd go with the blue. So recently, I've been on a pink kick, and it's hard because all the cliches that around pink, which are basically that it's swish or it's preppy, seem extremely prejudiced. I feel like pink is a color, you know, and it should be liberated. There's a guitar for sale, a pink Stratocaster for sale, that is so completely rock and roll. And I'm really, I stare at it online pretty much every night thinking, do I dare play a pink guitar? I hope someday I can get over my heteronormative self and embrace the pink.
I love interviewing someone who uses the word heteronormative. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen that often. In your current tour, there's the people versus ape section of the show. You've done that for a while now. Who usually wins, the people or the apes?
It's completely fixed. It's something we started doing about 12 years ago and only did it for a couple of years. And we brought it back about a year ago because it was just so much fun. It was just a way to kind of get everybody in the audience amped up. Typically, like John and I are representing the apes on stage and the other guys in the band are representing the people. It's a way to kind of to throw the people a bone.
John Flansburgh, will you be reactivating the Monopuff project at all? I've had to listen to Devil Went Down to Newport. Ever doing anything with that again?
The devil went down to Newport town. He brought his red surfboard to race against the Lord. It was totally rocking. It was totally rocking. It was totally rocking. It was totally rocking.
I worked with Hal Cragen a little bit on the Jonathan Colton album that I produced. He does a lot of work in Los Angeles, so it's hard for us. I like doing outside work. I think keeping busy is a way to keep loose. Doing outside projects is always a very different challenge, and it gets you out of your comfort zones. I would love to do it.
I have to ask you about working with John Linnell for so long, and particularly touring for almost 30 years. You must know just about everything about each other. You've told each other all secrets. You know every single thing about each other. Is that a good thing at this point?
It's very comfortable. There's more respect there now than there was when we started. I think we recognize what is invaluable about the other person. We appreciate each other more. It's a healthy challenge. It's very different than being just a band leader or being a front person. Being in a duo that carries on, I think, is actually, it makes you a better person. I think it's made me a better person. Oh, you know what I've really got to do? I've desperately got to take a shower before I do this show.
I didn't think it was actually possible to smell someone through Skype, but you stink, man.
It's horrible. It's a nightmare.
I was going to ask about John Hodgman reading Dimension of Miracles. I assume you have listened to that audiobook. Is it good?
I haven't heard it, but he's a great... We've done spoken word things with John Hodgman from the very beginning of his career. You know, we're big fans. He's got a great style. He's an inspired guy.
Chapter 21. Carmody blinked. He was no longer exchanging views with the dinosaur in the Cretaceous Age. Now he was somewhere else. He was in a small, dingy room. A man was seated behind a high roll-top desk. The man said, "I am the Honorable Clyde Beadle Seathright. And you are Mr. Carmody, of course. I trust that your trip from Mr. Maudsley's planet was a pleasant one." "It was fine," Carmody said, sitting down. He knew he was being ungracious, but the abrupt transitions were beginning to get him down.
"Well, let's finish off with your favorite song from Nanobots. What would you like me to play? Anything off it? Anyone at all?"
"I would request the track The Darlings of Lumberland, which was a collaboration we did with a saxophone player named Stan Harrison. He's Listeners would know him almost right away from the very crazy sounding and kind of distinct saxophone that's in Let's Dance.
That David Bowie song, that sax sting's very distinctive."
"Yeah, it's distorted and it almost doesn't really sound like a saxophone." Is an amazing musician and has a really, really sophisticated sense of harmonics. He's startling to be around because he plays at such an incredible level. Basically, we put this track together with him. We put together the rhythm track and left a lot of space harmonically for him to kind of create melodies, kind of a very dense horn chart on top of it. So a lot of what you hear is really from the pen of and the crazy mind of Stan Harrison. It's really an exciting track and kind of a different turn for us. And it was a way of working that was really a pure pleasure. You know, one of the nice things about this project is even 30 years into it, there's still like a lot of new musical ground being covered. And I think this is a pretty good example of it."
John Flansburgh, back in Australia after 12 years with John Linnell. Don't make it so long next time. You've got sock monkeys on stage. The only thing missing from your show currently, I reckon, is a confetti cannon.
Next time, we'll get it through customs.